is called to order. It is 3:38, March 11th, Monday. We do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator Wagner, French, Co-Chair Wilikowski, Senator Huggins, Senator Stevens, Senator Sedman, and myself, McGuire. And we have one item on the agenda today, and that's an overview of Alaska's oil and gas fiscal design. And this is sort of a recap of what we've done and in preparation for the potential fiscal terms that we'll set for gas that we have not reflected on yet, that Senator Wilikowski and I have discussed, along with other committee members, the desire to do so in the coming 2 years. So without further ado, we have Commissioner of Revenue, Pat Galvin, and we have Rich Ruggiero with Ruggiero, Gaffney, Klein, and Associates, who we know well, and we're looking forward to hearing from you. We also have Dan Dickinson here as well for a resource for the committee. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Department of Revenue. And as you indicated, what we would like to talk about is the oil and gas production tax, but focusing specifically on the gas side. There's been discussion earlier in the session with regard to how the production tax relates to gas, and particularly a focus on what happens when we see large-scale commercialization of North Slope gas. How does that affect the system? And I very much appreciate the opportunity to present this. This is an area that within the administration we've spent a tremendous amount of time working on. It not only was a part of our work leading into the ACES session and the presentations during that session, but also was a big part of the AGEA analysis that we did in preparing all the economic analysis that was done in response to that process and was presented last summer. And so this is sort of an opportunity to put all that into context and provide a picture of how the state's fiscal system works as it relates to a gas pipeline situation. And I very much appreciate your participation in this. I commented to the audience that we used to play to pack houses, and we're seeing a little bit of a thinning, but that should not be seen as a reflection on the magnitude of this issue in the future of the state. And I do appreciate the legislature's opportunity, or providing us the opportunity to talk about this. What I wanted to do first off is just sort of frame the issue as we see it, where we stand today, and the way that we see the state's fiscal system, and then turn it over to Rich to provide some of the more detailed picture of how the system works, give a little bit of a refresher for those who in the audience who may not be as familiar with the system as you all are, about what ACES is and how it works, and then talk about the interrelationship between oil and gas and moving forward towards a system where we see more gas production than what we see today. And also, what I wanted to use this opportunity is to talk about what we have found, which is that the state's fiscal system as it relates to gas is entirely sound, that it is entirely legitimate in the sense of being a structure that can support the development of our natural gas resources. It is crafted to protect the state's revenue both before and after gas commercialization. It is a system that provides for an incentive to develop that resource, the gas resource, which is something that we have all talked about wanting to have the state provide, and we want to make sure that that is recognized as a key part of the gas tax system. And then finally, because the system provides that flexibility between a system where there is no gas production and one where there is gas production, we believe it provides a stable system that provides the durability that the companies are looking for in a fiscal system so that they have the confidence to move forward with gas commercialization under our current structure. And then, in addition to providing that overview and that picture, we also wanted to talk about how the discussion of this is something that will be an ongoing discussion as we move towards the open season or open seasons associated with the large gas pipeline. That there will be information that will become available to us as we move forward, information with regard to the pipeline tariff, the pipeline economics, that we will have the opportunity to factor into our analysis and determine whether or not any changes are needed. But it is important for us to have a common understanding of the way our system works so that as that information comes in, it can feed into that discussion and we can be talking about it in a set of common terms so we are understanding the way that it works. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Rich to go through the detailed information, and we'd be happy to answer questions throughout.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Galvin. Senator Stedman.
Just, Madam Chairman, just, you know, so before we get going here on this subject, which can get very, very involved, it appears that we have an agreement to disagree, I guess is a nice way of characterizing how we look at the gas tax as it sits today. And for those folks that are home that are watching us, when we did PPT initially under the previous administration, basically removed the gas equation out of the oil tax and concentrated on dealing with the oil tax, and then under ACES, virtually the same thing. And I have the impression from the administration that they had a concentration on the gas tax internally within ACES. But I think you'll find that a lot of the elected officials in the legislature do not view it like that. And we have no gas to sell at the moment. And our concentration was on dealing with oil, gas to come sometime later, and defaulted out the BTU equivalency just to get the issue off the table so we can concentrate on the issue at hand, which is oil taxes and the need to restructure it. So I wouldn't want the people at home to think that the legislature has signed off on a gas structure embedded in ACES or PPT.
Do you want to comment, Commissioner?
Well, Senator Stedman, I understand the position, and I guess if there is a need to agree to disagree, the system that has been put in place has always been an oil and gas system. It's been built upon a barrel of oil equivalent. It was built upon the concept that it was a singular system for both an oil production and gas production. And there was discussion with regard to if we had separate systems, the complications that would create with regard to allocation of costs and other things that were seen as detrimental to a stable system if we were going to separate those. The question with regard to the economics, I think it's safe to say that almost all of the economic data that was presented related to the analysis of the system was done with the current oil production being the root of that analysis. But what we're presenting today is to say that two things. One, the issue of how the system would work in an oil and gas world was not something that we ignored. It was something that we were aware of, but we recognized that at the time it wasn't part of the public discussion, and it would be part of the discussion as we move closer towards gas commercialization. What we also are here to talk about is the fact that when we did the analysis under AGEA, what we found is that the current system is a very robust system. It's very amenable to a variety of circumstances that will present itself in the future related to the mixture of oil and gas. and that it provides for a system that is favorable both to the state and to the producers, regardless of how the future presents itself in terms of that production. And so what we want to provide for you is that information so that it's a part of the discussion going forward.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, hey, welcome. Good to see you. There's two parts, and I don't think I'm not prepared to debate the legitimacy of the existing system. Let's assume it's legitimate. But it's kind of like a race car. You know, if you go to NASCAR, and in 2008, they're running, and the next year they may have the same carcass of a vehicle, but they've tweaked some pieces to it. My assumption, there's this fiscal regime has some of those traits that potentially could be tweaked, because as we learn over time, there are some modifications that might be required, but we'll learn about that as we go along. My concern today, and hopefully we can reach a conclusion on this sooner than later, is your last bullet says, must continue discussions. And on that continue discussions timeline, going from open season in 2010 back to now, some marks on that timeline where you have the same expectation as the co-chairs do of when we're going to make some decisions, yes or no, are we going to have further discussions and not just agree to have further discussion? So we have some mark on the wall when we can anticipate we either make a decision or we change or whatever the action item is. And that's the thing that's always been frustrating to me, because we're just going to continue to talk about it like it's just a continuing conversation. There's a lot at stake here in decisions or lack of decisions. In that, I mean, it may be just, nope, there's no decision required, we just continue to march. But I would appreciate the opportunity to have a timeline that we agreed upon, that we can anticipate upon, and maybe come to a better conclusion if there are some changes that are required.
Senator Huggins, through the chair. I agree entirely. Looking at the likely progression as we move towards an open season, and right now we're looking at the first open season being TransCanada's, concluding in July 2010. For planning purposes, what I would submit is that if we were going to entertain changes to the fiscal system, changes to the gas tax system prior to that open season, we would need to have them in place during the 2010 legislative session. In order to do that, we would need, if it was going to be something that we brought forward, brought to you, it would be incumbent on us to present it to you at the beginning of that session or prior to the beginning of that session, mm-hmm. so that you would have adequate time to review it and consider it before passing it during the session. What the only uncertainty in there is if something were to advance unexpectedly in terms of something either coming from potential shippers or coming from the state in terms from the administration, that came to fruition before that, then there would be the possibility of a special session. But at this point, I do not anticipate that. That is, I would consider that to be extremely low likelihood. I would consider it to be the most likely scenario to be one where either, one, we're here before you at the beginning of the next legislative session saying that we have reviewed information, we continue to monitor it, and we do not feel that there are any changes that are needed, or that we are presenting to you at the beginning of the session a proposal to make a change prior to the open season. Now, the one thing to note is that the idea of going back to your NASCAR analogy, a carcass or the shell of a car with tweaks within the engine, for example, once we hit the open season, the gas that's committed at the open season gets the commitment to lock in the system for 10 years. And so no further tweaks will be allowed, theoretically, post 10 years after first gas. So we have to make sure that if we are anticipating the need for any tweaks, that we have made that decision prior to the open season. And frankly, going back to my observation earlier that the current system, we believe, provides the durability. The part that durability is based on the inherent flexibility of the system, that you're locking in under the current system a fairly flexible system, and that will deal with a variety of potential outcomes moving forward. And that's what we see as a very valuable thing for both the state and for other participants in the project. But going back to the point, timeline-wise, I would say that the timing of the open season provides an opportune window at the legislative session 2010 to resolve these issues.
Senator Wilikowski, and then Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pat, my understanding is that TransCanada, in order to have be prepared for the open season in next July, has to have cost estimates by around January or February next year. Is that correct?
Most likely they'll be submitting their open season applications to FERC in that time frame. And so they'll have to be up on cost estimates and other things by then.
Is that a factor in your timetable at all to find out what the cost estimates are? Because obviously, from my perspective, that probably would be an important factor, because we want to make sure that this is an economic project. And everything we've heard is that it is, but that'll really be the proof that it is or is not. How does that factor into your timetable?
It does factor in slightly, in the sense that it provides us with the opportunity, if we are discussing the system during that period of time, we will have the most up-to-date information on the tariff and cost estimates, so that our economic analysis will be as current as possible. At this point, we have not received any information that would indicate that the cost estimates that we used during the AGEA session are now need to be revisited. In fact, most of what we're hearing, anecdotally at least, is that some of the cost estimates may be too high because of the environment that we are in at that time versus the environment we're in right now in terms of general costs. But as we move closer to the end of this calendar year, we would expect to hear more from TransCanada in terms of if they're seeing significant changes in the cost estimates. But again, a lot of this goes back to the inherent, for lack of a better word, flexibility within the fiscal system, that it provides for a certain margin of error as it relates to estimates of costs and other things that still provide the appropriateness of the tax rate and so forth to still be appropriate even at different potential cost estimates, because it's based upon net profits and so forth.
And just follow. Yeah, another question, and don't take a long time on this, please, because the purpose of this hearing is not to discuss, is to discuss the tax regime. But I think this is an important question that's come up quite a bit, and that is with the credit crunch, with the state of the economy, with gas at $3.80, shale plays, with import. The LNG surpluses, is there anything that you've seen or that the administration has seen that would lead the administration to believe that this is no longer a viable project or that is less viable than it was? And just in 30 seconds or less.
The answer is no. And the reason is that the economics of this project are driven by estimates of what is going to happen in the market 10 years out plus. The issues that we hear with regard to shale gas, LNG, credit crunch, those are all short-term issues over the next 4 to 5 years. I was just, as an aside, I was back in New York last week meeting on credit stuff, but I also spent some time with some of our energy consultants talking about their view in the future, and they reiterated that these issues associated with changes in the gas market are short-term effects, that the long-term expectations with regard to both gas prices, gas supply, and then the side issue about the credit issues are probably going to be back within our projections from the GEA process, our GEA analysis, once the project is actually in play. So the answer to your question is no, we don't see anything that has caused our expectations to change.
Senator Steadman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just to add on to Senator Huggins' a question and Senator Wilikowski's, I know there's a lot of interest to get a better cost estimate of this project before we get into any detail dealing with the gas tax issue. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. If we don't know what the cost of the project is, it's pretty hard to set that rate or go in and modify or adjust some issues and within the tax structure we have now. But with all due respect, Madam Chairman, we can't do it in 90 days.
Yeah.
When we look at the complexity of oil, it took us years. And if we would have accepted the adamant presentation that was given to us by the previous administration, it would not have been beneficial to the state at all. And we had made modifications of that through that administration and then into the current administration. Gas is an added complexity within this oil. I'm sure the legislature is going to have some differences of opinion. Mm-hmm. And one of them, which is probably going to be progressivity, a portion of the tax on high oil prices or high gas prices. And we'll probably have a little differences with the administration to work out. And if we can't come to an agreement by the end of the 90 days session, we run the risk of adding risk layers into the open season, which I don't think any of us want to do. We want to have a successful open season. So, Madam Chairman, I'm very concerned that leaving this issue for a 90-day session is a recipe for a train wreck.
And I would just tag on to what Senator Steadman has said, and I think at the outset of our hearings here in Senate Resources, Senator Wilikowski and I were asked, what are our priorities in order? And the number one priority was to look at a gas tax structure for that very reason. And the timing of it we left on the table. And we understand the issues that you've presented and will discuss with us today. But the concern really is that, if you're looking at the spring of next year and mid-January start date for the session, all of the things that come with it. We have a budget to deal with every single year. There'll be big issues that are on the table for the legislature, and to try to digest something like this in that period of time seems overwhelming. And so I'd invite you, Commissioner, to continue to work with this committee. We had looked at and talked about introducing our own legislation on the part of the Senate Resources Committee, and we're not ruling that out. But we certainly would like to continue the dialogue with the administration, and we think that the interim might be an opportunity to really tackle some of the big issues surrounding this kind of a major change in the fiscal system. And I would just point out another aspect. If you don't think that tweaks in the tax policy make a difference, just look at what's happened in Nenana and Cook Inlet. Nenana in particular, and it was in this committee a year and a half ago that we put the amendment in to line up the Nenana Basin with the Cook Inlet tax incentives for gas, and look at what we've seen as a result of that in just a short time. So we know that it influences investment decisions and exploration, and we think it will make a difference in open season. I think you've conceded as much, and we certainly just don't want to be irresponsible and allow that policy decision to come right up to the edge of that open season and in any way jeopardize our shot. So.
And Madam Chair, I understand and I accept the message. I'm looking forward to working with this committee on those issues, but I guess I want to reiterate the primary message that I'm hoping to deliver today, which is that we do not anticipate the need for any major overhaul to our tax system associated with movement towards an open season. At best, we might expect some small tweaks to it based upon something that is presented that is looking at it from a perspective that we have not looked at it from before. But from each direction that we've looked at it previously, up to now, what we have found is that the current tax system that's in place now is appropriate for going to an open season. And it's going to be a matter of new information coming forward that would justify the need to change that. And so I think I don't want to leave the public with the expectation that the administration feels that a change in the tax system is going to be needed prior to an open season. Right now, we don't see the need for one. And we're just leaving open the door that there may be new information that comes forward. But the tax system that's in place right now, from everywhere that we've looked at it, from all directions associated with the advancement of this gas pipeline, it serves the state's needs and the producers' needs and the pipeline's needs.
Okay. And on that point, we look forward to your presentation. That's a great segue to hear your mental state. And so the assumption, you know, that we will base it on then is that barring any new information, you believe that this is the proper structure and that would then be essentially locked in for the next decade per the AGEA incentives contained in open season. Okay.
Madam Chairman, Senators, for the record, Rich Ruggiero from Gaffney, Klein & Associates. Thank you for having me up here to Juneau again. And I have a few slides in a presentation today, and I was reminded when I was here last time by several of the committee members that with the limited time I had, I flew through things pretty fast. And some of the slides may not have been explanatory enough for those that are sitting at home listening or watching or wanting to read things, or may not be as au fait with the details of ACES as we've gone through it. So I'm going to go back through the key principles because what I took away from the last time I was here is that there was concern raised by one of the other consultants that things were seriously wrong with ACES, especially when you looked at gas. And as you heard in my testimony, I did not think that was correct, just the opposite. I think ACES and what was presented is exactly how it was intended to work. It may, if you pick one day here or one day there or 1 hour's worth of prices, you might find a set of scenarios that look alarming. But I think the one thing we have to remember is a gas pipeline is something that will be 10-plus years in development and hopefully 50-plus years in its life. And so what you're looking at is putting together systems that act over the long term. And over periods that are that long, we'll see many ups and downs in the industry, especially with respect to pricing and costs that seem to follow that pricing. So with that as a background, I'd like to go through the slides and, again, welcome questions as they come. I just wanted to repeat that, you know, when we were here during ACES, these sort of five key drivers, when we put this when we gave our recommendations to the administration and putting together the form that ACES took. And, you know, one of the key things where I've got the arrow is that we did want to look at something that would encourage the investment in gas as well as other what we called high-priced, potentially high-priced operations such as the unconventional or heavy oil. So very clearly we were looking at gas at the time that we were giving our input into the ACES development. To go back just on and this is a very simplistic look, and I accept that I've left out property taxes and I've left out a number of other smaller things, but I wanted to try and break down for the people that are watching very simplistically where ACES comes into this picture is that with oil, you'll start with a market price and we'll take off transportation, both taps and shipping, to get to West Coast markets. You come up with a unit value from that. We take off royalty. The producers are then able to deduct their operating expenses, and something which is fairly unique in the industry around the world is they also get to immediately deduct any and all capital expenses. Mm-hmm. And this produces a resulting what we call producer cash flow. I mean, we've talked about ACES as before being a tax on profit, but it's actually a tax on the non-reinvested cash flow. And so when you get this cash flow, we then calculate, based on whatever that cash flow is on a per-barrel basis, the production tax. That then is deductible against owed federal and state income tax, and what you get out the bottom then would be what you consider the producer profit. When we go to gas, it works the same way. The main differences being that instead of looking at West Coast U.S. markets for oil, we'll be looking at something like AECO Hub, maybe Chicago City Gate, or some other pricing hub in the lower 48 for pricing the gas. We'll then subtract transportation off again to get to unit value. That may be transportation in your Trans-Alaska pipeline, as well as maybe a number of different pipelines and or processing facilities in Canada or the lower 48 before we ultimately get to that market price. Again, subtract royalty, OPEX, CAPEX, and then your ACES tax is calculated, and then we come up with a producer profit. Now, I presented both of these simplistic.
Just a real thanks, Madam Chair. Just a real quick clarification. When you say processing, you don't mean a gas conditioning plant on the North Slope. Is that correct?
I'm mainly talking about NGL processing, which usually occurs in the midstream or the downstream sectors.
I'm just recalling from a lengthy period of time that we spent working out the ACES tax that we put the point of production for gas downstream of a gas conditioning plant on the North Slope.
And Senator French, through the chair, for the purposes of ACES, you're correct. Gas treatment plant is downstream point of production, which means it is not deductible as an expense.
It's upstream of the point of production.
No, down.
It's down.
Everything that's upstream of the point of production is considered a lease expenditure, which means it is deductible.
Oh, got it. Okay. Yep. Thanks. Okay.
So what's downstream?
It's part of the pipeline. It's a tariff cost.
And it becomes a incremental cost as opposed to a capital cost.
Yeah. Just got my upstreams and my downstreams a little screwed around. Right?
You're still on the stream. That's good.
I'm still in the stream.
Still in the stream. Now, what I did want to point out is even though I put up separate slides for oil and gas, I'm just showing how you calculate the values on a barrel of oil equivalent basis as you come back. But ACES is actually a combined tax. So you'd actually be taking the combined oil and gas net values and adding them together to come up with a production-weighted average, and that's the value upon which the actual production tax would be calculated and paid. As you combine that, again, just for a quick review, the available cash flow up to $30 a barrel is taxed at a flat 25% base tax rate, and then once the cash flow per barrel gets above $30, there is a progressivity factor that kicks in, and ACES has two progressivity factors. The first one runs from $30 a barrel cash flow up to $92.50 at the rate of 0.4% increase in the tax for every dollar per BOE cash flow above the 30. The net result, and you ask why was the 92.5 picked, and that was because if you do the mathematics, you'll find that you end up right at 50% production tax at $92.5 per barrel cash flow. Above that point, a second progressivity factor then comes into play, and it's basically one quarter of the previous progressivity, but we do add 0.1% to the tax rate for every dollar per barrel equivalent of cash flow above the $92.50. Graphically, just to kind of give an idea of how progressivity comes into play versus the base tax rate, this is just showing over a range of West Coast oil prices and with the assumption of a $25 cost in to produce, you'll see the various impacts at different prices of either the base tax and or progressivity as it comes into play.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ruggiero, I know that calculating, going back one slide to plug in the same idea on gas prices requires you to know what the current ratio is between the two commodities. But it'd be helpful for me, at least, to have, you know, whatever you consider the base case ratio to be, to have that plugged in for gas on that same progressivity range. Does that make sense?
Yes, Senator French, the chair. I try and get into this issue of gas-oil parity again a little bit later.
And do you have a similar slide like that once you finish that discussion, or no?
No, but I do have some slides that show when you do combine both an expected North Slope gas production with the oil production, what the resultant tax picture could possibly look like.
Thank you. It just, and I recognize it's a little difficult to split them out because you can't split them out, but it's still helpful, I think, just for sort of a general tutorial to be able to say, you know, at, you know, gas hits, you know, a profit somewhere around this value, and at this value, 50%, you know, you start kicking into progressivity, and then at this value, you kick into, you know, the tail.
Yes, Senator French, we get into some other things, but if people accept that, and I have slides that get into this, the thermal parity is 6-1. If I had a standalone gas project, no oil whatsoever, then the base rate of 25% would be applicable for cash flow, and that it would be above all the cost and royalty, of $5 per MMBTU. That would be the equivalent of the $30 kickoff point. Progressivity would then kick in all the way up to roughly $16 per MMBTU, which would be plus or minus the equivalent of the 92.5. So that would be the cash flow that people would be realizing above their costs associated with the project.
Just final comment, and that's helpful. That's exactly what I had in mind, because there will be people that are not combined oil and gas producers, we hope, on the North Slope. There'll be lots of folks who are just simply producing gas, and their tax is going to be calculated, you know, without the two being commingled. They're going to be, you know, paying tax on the gas they produce.
And on that point, too, is we'll get into the discussion of thermal parity, but those of us that returned from the Energy Council were exposed to very interesting discussion on the matter of thermal parity and what's going to happen in the natural gas market vis-a-vis the oil market. Discussions about shale and all of the newfound discoveries in natural gas and what that might do to the market, and how for so many years they have been linked. There has been somewhat of a link, the 6x factor and so on, but the world may not look like that in the future. And so these are good questions, and we'll get into that and continue that discussion. But certainly these kinds of charts are only understandable through the lens of thermal parity. You might want to reconsider how we can view them through a separate light, depending on what philosophy you buy into about how the world will look. And so that, you know, and I mean, I think that's a broader point that Senator Stedman and Huggins have made as well, which is that it may be more appropriate to decide on a tax regime for natural gas that truly is about natural gas and all of the assumptions that we're going to make about it, how we want to incentivize it, how we want to consider capital investments in it, separate from crude oil.
Again, just to show a distribution of costs, and I realize choosing a $75 per barrel West Coast price is a little outrageous in today's market, but the slide was handy. This just shows a breakdown of that $75. Basically, starting at the bottom, we have the cost associated with producing and moving it to market. We then would have royalty, production tax, property tax, income taxes, and finally, after that, the value that's left over for the producers. And so this will give you an idea of the relative distribution. The one thing I wanted to do is take that and let's break it down, that if we take the cost away, basically what we have is $50 per barrel of profit or economic rent to be shared between the various parties that are involved. And so if we take the pieces that represent that economic rent and break it out, you'll see of that $50 of profit, the producers end up with about 34%, the federal government ends up with 20%, and the state ends up with about 46%. So on a $75 barrel oil, with today's roughly $25 rounded cost structure for operating expenditures, CapEx, and transportation, this is the type of breakdown that you get for the economic rent that's available.
Madam Chair. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Rich, could you go back? there's been, it appears to me, at least some speculation about what the federal government's going to do as far as taxes. And in the case of oil and gas, is the offset that was allowed on state taxes not being allowed, call it windfall. I mean, you characterize it ever how you want. What would happen if that transpired in this percentage?
Senator Huggins,
would you get a credit for on the federal level? You get a credit for the state taxes that you've been paying as an offset to the federal correct taxes. Could you help me out on that percentile, what it would look like?
Senator Huggins, the chair, I've not run that to take a look at. But in anticipation of that question, because I saw it on one of the blogs, I did go and take a look in great detail at what President Obama rolled out in his fiscal 2010 budget. And there was some representation that in there was a manufacturing credit. He's clawing back some $13 billion is the estimate over the 10-year planning horizon within that budget. And that actually is not about state production taxes. It was actually a manufacturing credit that went in for multiple industries. And what he's looking at doing is repealing the energy's industry's eligibility for that credit. And it mainly goes to investments in refineries. Because we had such an old refinery base, and we wanted to encourage more creation of products by importing the crude oil and creating the products in the U.S., that tax was put in there. But the taxes that are in President Obama's plan that would impact the state, the one that would is the one on the immediate deductibility of intangible drilling costs, which would go from being expensed to using MACRA 7, or basically being depreciated over a 7-year period and recovered in that manner.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. In any event, the one thing we do know is that we have about $14 trillion worth of debt. We're going to be looking for revenue at the federal level. I say to you, there's an eligibility factor, and I would appreciate you running the numbers so we could see what the impact would be, because I think it's an important question to be answered.
Senator Huggins, the chair, we can run that. Yes.
And just so that we're clear on the nature of the question, so assuming that the federal government does not allow the companies to deduct their state income
correct
taxes from
correct
their federal income tax,
correct,
what would be the resulting
correct
distribution? Okay.
Correct.
We can
Senator Stedman.
Madam Chair, Chairwoman, if we could maybe ask him to adjust the price. I know we've got all kinds of fancy mathematical wizards around here. Maybe pull that $75 price down to $50 or somewhere down in the range of where it is around today. And
really?
Then if you want to run other numbers too, it'd just be kind of nice to take a look at where we're at today.
And it just because the point has been raised with regard to the price, I think it's important to get some perspective on how ACES works with regard to high prices and low prices. With the prices where they are today in the $40 range, ACES is actually bringing in less revenue than the ELF tax did under some similar circumstances in terms of the overall cost and production estimates. And so what we have described is a system that has less government take on the low end and more on the high end, and that's playing out during this wild swing. What we see is the state's taking much less than we did previously at these low prices in order to keep the companies investing. and taking more on the up end. So
yeah.
Just want to make that observation.
Senator Stepin.
If we could get that quantified.
Would you like this breakdown at a lower price? Is that another two aspects?
Well, it's just kind of a separate question, Madam Chairman, but you know, the comparison was drawn of you know, less revenue under ELF, which we would less revenue under the current system than under the old ELF system, which we would expect. There was some discussion during the PPT process where that point is, and as we all know, we've changed quite a bit underneath there through ACES. So maybe we can have that recalculated, just for curiosity.
I know part of the answer, basically the crossover point given the current cost estimates, because that's the variable that changes. With the cost estimate changing, your crossover point changes. With the current cost estimates, the crossover point between ELF and ACES is in between $50 and $55 per barrel.
Yeah.
One of the other topics that we talked about during the ACES special session was the issue between absolute rates and marginal rates. Clearly, we had a curve that you could plot out and calculate based on cash flow that started at 25%, went up at one slope to 50%, and then went slightly up from there, which would be the absolute tax rate that you would calculate based on whatever your cash flow per barrel was as it calculated out. But one of the things that we saw in doing this is we also started talking about the second goal that we had of the five goals that we had in the first slide, but it was encouraging reinvestment. And what we took a look at was if there was some activity in the field that could be the increased production or that might be increased investment that would move or would cause a movement of $1 per barrel on the cash flow, either up or down. And we said, what was the marginal effect of that happening? And what we see on both the plot that's on the left and on the right, you'll see a set of curves, as we can see here, that comes up off the what I call the absolute curve, and this is our marginal curve. And that basically was giving us an idea of what the overall tax savings would be should an additional dollar per barrel of cash flow be made as capital investment in Alaska, or what the additional tax would be if profitability increased by that same dollar per barrel. As you can see, depending on where you were as a starting point, those numbers ranged as high as plus or minus around 82%. If you then took into account and you were looking at incremental investment, then you had the investment tax credit. Even though that's now 20% spread out over 2 years, you actually could get to the point where government, through both the state and the federal, were contributing close to the full dollar of every dollar invested by the oil companies if they happened to be right at that right point for the year of averaging right at $92.5 per barrel of oil equivalent. Mm-hmm. What we also showed, though, the effect that this marginal versus absolute rate would have is when we combine operations. Again, one of the big things we looked at with respect to a gas development is we clearly would have North Slope gas coming into a pipeline to make it viable. And so we said gas is on a per barrel of oil equivalent basis in any market priced, it would be less valuable and would have less cash flow. And so, therefore, what would be the impact of combining gas with a less cash flow per barrel with the oil that would have very high cash flow per barrel? And what we said is you might find, as we look in the left curve, that your legacy fields at the time might be up here somewhere around the $70 to $80 per barrel cash flow. Heavy oil would be down here, gas even lower. That when you combine any of these two together, you would get a combined point on the curve, and that would then give you, as we'll show on some of the subsequent slides that we get to, that there is a bit of subsidy to causing that investment to happen as we move forward. The reason we went through this is to show that part of putting ACES together was looking at the fact that there was other development by existing players in existing units that was much lower dollar value per unit. And the one thing we wanted to make sure that for the state is a tax regime did not get put in place that would significantly discourage investment in those type of operations. To go even further, we talked about the subsidy, and again, these are slides that come out of, I believe it's a November 9th presentation to Senate Finance at the time. Went through a multiple, about 20 slide buildup to show that as you looked at multiple fields coming on, that indeed the net effect of this marginal kick due to progressivity, that if field Z, as noted in the slide, was an actual, let's say it was a gas development, that its net effective tax rate could be even below, in this case it's up here as 18%+, it could be even lower than the base tax rate that we have of 25. And how does that occur? That occurs because in the combining process and of moving down this marginal curve, the progressivity gives us a slight difference than just straight numerical averaging.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rich, how do other countries deal with this issue? Do they decouple oil and gas taxes? Is this is our structure common with other countries?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, some countries have the same tax structure, some have different. We start getting into one first is ring fencing. Is you can have certain countries allow ring fencing by the country as a whole, which in essence is what you do with ACES. Sometimes they allow ring fencing by individual fields. So even though they may have the same tax structure, you may not be able to combine oil and gas because if they come from two separate fields, they may be ring fenced off from each other for the calculation of tax. The UK used to have a production tax somewhat similar, and they used to ring fence by field, so it was kind of hard to offset field A versus field B. There are some countries that do combine the oil and gas together, and some have very similar terms for the two, and in some cases they have slightly different treatment for gas versus the oil.
For our purposes where we have legacy fields, Prudhoe, Kuparuk, do you have an opinion about whether it's in our best interest to ring fence or keep everything together to encourage production of a gas pipeline, encourage production of fields, and encourage production of putting gas into the gas pipeline?
Senator Wilikowski, the chair. I believe that the way that it is set up now with all of the incentives that you've got built into it, that is a very workable fiscal system to go forward with on the natural gas. Is it better if you separate? Once you start separating, then you start getting into predicting the future and having to come up with fairly strong beliefs in what certain parameters will be cost and revenue-wise in order to set a very specific tax structure for a very specific project.
And just one last question, Madam Chair, if I could. And maybe Rich, maybe for Pat, but how difficult would it be to administer two different systems accounting-wise?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I think the word I used at the last hearing was that's opening Pandora's box. There are some people that say it's pretty simple to do, and there are some simple ways that you can separate what is a gas cost from an oil cost so that way you can run separate oil and gas taxes. But each and every one of those simplistic methods comes with quite a bit of compromise that you'll then have to, and it'll either mean a gain or a loss for one party or the other by the method of the separation, in which case then you'll have to compensate for that then when you build in the, call it the tax terms, understanding how you did that division between the two. But if you tried to be very exact between what was kit that was used for gas versus what kit was used for oil, you can create an excessive administrative burden.
Senator Stedman.
Well,
If I can just add a little bit on, just to put it in the context that we were discussing during ACES, if you remember, we had the primary discussion during the session was gross versus net. And one of the distinctions that was made between having a gross-based tax and net-based tax is that a gross-based tax, as Rich just alluded to, you're going to have to make a lot of assumptions. And if your assumptions are wrong, then your tax can be wildly off, either in the direction of very much discouraging investment or very much under
overtaxing.
Oh, undertaxing, actually. If you could undertax, you know, just not perform as a revenue generation, or you could discourage investment. The simple ways of administering a oil versus a gas tax would be to create a formula-based separation of the costs between the two. That's basically somewhat of the equivalent of a gross-based tax. You're just sort of arbitrarily establishing a number that will be a proxy for what the actual costs may be. And then on the other hand, on the net-based side, what we were concerned about was the concern about gaming the system and the ability to move costs around in order to maximize revenue to the taxpayer and minimize their tax obligations. If you have, again, a separate gas and oil system that you do not create the formulas to arbitrarily establish those and you allow them to just report them, then you create the opportunity, as Rich says, the Pandora's box, where it will be an accounting nightmare to try to chase down whether those costs are properly allocated between oil and gas, and you'll end up with a significant opportunity for gaming the system. And so that's why between the two you end up, if you separate them, you're inviting that next level of difficult choices in terms of, are you going to go with the equivalent of a gross versus a net.
Senator Stedman.
Madam Chair, maybe we could ask them to come forward with a list of different basins around the world and in which ones have combined oil and gas, which ones have separate tax scenarios with oil and gas, and if there's any out there that have combined with separate progressivities, one on oil, one on gas.
We can ask Rich to provide that.
That would be great. Give us a background.
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair. We can put together such a list. One of the things, too, that would come out of that is the fact that some countries have different generations of deals, and even some new projects are under older arrangements. So with some countries, we'd probably be showing that there are multiple ways in which some of those things are handled.
Senator Stedman.
Well, hopefully, Madam Chairman, that as we go down this conversation over the next few months, we won't end up redebating the gross versus net. I think we're concluded that we're in the net regime, and we're, just so you don't misinterpret some of the comments. When you talk, when some of us talk about alterations in our tax or reviewing the gas tax, isn't turning it upside down and going some different direction.
Right.
And to understand through the chair, I was not at all insinuating that we would go to a gross tax system, other than to say if you separate out oil and gas, you're going to have to find a way to allocate the cost between the two. And then to have a formula-based allocation, it is analogous to the problems that we saw with the gross-based taxes that we were analyzing. Yeah. And that was my point, to put it into a context that we're all familiar with in terms of the limitations on that type of a system, and then the alternative being the equivalent of a net-based approach on the allocation of the costs, then you end up very much exacerbating the auditing challenge that we have.
Okay. Continue. At our last session, beginning of February, there was talk of subsidy and in this the impact of progressivity when you have a very high valued or high cash flow field being combined with a lower valued or low valued field. So just how big is the subsidy? And I think this goes even to Senator Stedman to a question you asked earlier about, you know, the need to know the capital cost of a project going in. Capital cost, as I've got up here, there are a number of different factors and variables that have to be looked at, and you have to look at them across the range of expected future on those. And including that is the oil and gas parities we talked to. You're going to have quality adjustments, which will come into the pricing of the product relative to the general market marker. And a couple of things that were not included either in my analysis or the analysis you saw from Mr. Dickinson is that there may be, and there's been talk of, and there may be some loss of production, existing production, by lowering reservoir pressure to produce and sell gas as you move forward. But there also may be gains in the system that you may actually extend the life of fields and or facilities, because by having this extra revenue and cash flow, you're actually able to operate fields to much lower rates on the liquids. And obviously, if you got new development in, it should extend the life of taps by having the minimum amount of volume available to flow down the pipeline. My last point on there is we have to be, I believe, very careful that we don't look at a single day or a single day extrapolated to a single year snapshot to get a picture of exactly how ACES would work for a gas development. You have to look over the life of the project and how it goes forward. That's where if you actually go back and look at the AGEA documentation and look at the economic work that Black and Veatch did, they did full life cycle on the economics. They did full life cycle using ACES the way it exists, and that is with the same base rates, with the same kickoff points, with the same progressivity. And there you can see over a multiplicity of different field types, be it on state lands or federal lands, be it newly found, be it from existing units such as Prudhoe, all of that type of sensitivity is in great detail in the work that came out as part of a GIA from Black and Veatch. So using, again, just my caution, using single-day snapshots can be misleading, and I give that as a health warning, even though I'm about to do single-year snapshots for you. I think a big thing that came up is a question about this oil and gas parity and why might a certain range of prices be right or wrong or what we might expect going into the future. I think that was a question raised earlier here today about shale gas and or other unconventional supplies in the U.S. or LNG and what that would mean to the possible price of gas for Alaska gas coming down in lower 48. When we talk about parity, as I run through up there, basically 6,000 cubic feet of gas roughly, and I'm rounding some numbers, and it varies by the quality of the gas, but in rounded terms, a barrel of oil contains as much energy as 6,000 cubic feet of gas. And since a cubic foot of gas has roughly 1,000 BTUs per cubic foot, what we get is a barrel of oil is equivalent to about 6 million MMBTUs of gas. The simple way we apply that is then to take, if gas were to be priced at parity, you would just then take the oil price that's existing, divide it by 6, and that should equal the gas price in an MMBTU. So for my example on the 6-to-1, if oil in the market today was $60 a barrel, gas priced at parity to that oil would be $10 per MMBTU.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French and then Wilkowski.
And just to help me out, Mr. Ruggiero, about what that MMBTU translates into the valuation that we're more commonly used to using, which is dollars per 1,000 standard cubic feet.
I think the markets today, Senator French, to the chair, the markets today are actually priced in dollars per MMBTU.
Oh, okay.
And actually the futures trade in dollars per MMBTU, mm-hmm. and FERC has really mandated that. At least at that level, all the contracts are on dollars per MMBTU. The issue is that actually at many sales points.
We had the camera running when I asked that question.
Yeah. The problem is gas in the United States sells at anywhere from 900 BTU per cubic foot up to 12 to 1,300. And so you've got a factor about 1.4. And a lot of the early gaming in the system when the gas market opened up were people pricing on cubic feet versus MMBTUs, and there's even something called wet versus dry on gas and high heating value and low heating value. So there's been a standardization, but the prices that you'll see quoted at different markets or on NYMEX or Henry Hub is in dollars per MMBTU.
I'll never forget it. Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rich, a lot of talk about carbon tax. If the United States adopts the Kyoto Treaty, I would assume that the spread would increase. I would assume that that would essentially increase the cost of a barrel of oil, which would thereby increase the ratio. Have you given that any thought?
Senator Wilkowski, the chair, that thinking has not been built into what I've presented here today.
And just follow up, perhaps you can model somewhere down the line. I'd be interested to see. I've heard various figures thrown out, but I guess if we're going to enter into a realm where a barrel of oil is going to increase fairly dramatically and an MCF is not, that's certainly something we would want to factor in.
Madam Chair, perhaps to help on that, we have a separate study that we have commissioned from the contractors Black and Veatch on that one as well, but a different section of Black and Veatch, to look at various nationwide economic impact associated with the potential gas line. And as part of that, they are looking at the issues associated with supply and demand, and so there will be some information coming forward in relation to the potential impact of carbon tax and so forth on both the gas market and the pipeline.
Good to know.
One additional point as background to this slide is also during the AGEA discussion, we heard an awful lot about Asian LNG pricing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was priced at based off of near parity to oil. Many of the European long-term gas contracts from the suppliers have oil in the formula that calculates the price of gas at any time. Some of those are current, as in the current gas price is based on current oil. Some of those have as much as a three-month lag in there, so you can kind of predict in the future based on what the oil, 3 months from now, based on what the oil price is now. But when LNG dried up coming to the U.S., it was because in those other markets, gas was selling at a 6-to-1 parity, basically with the price of oil in those markets. Where does that come into play? Then we look at this next slide. If 6-to-1 is thermal parity, is we can take a look at this is just a slide of pricing that came out of the Black and Veatch work on AGEA. We can actually look at a long run that goes back quite significantly. This should be January 95 through 08, so we've got almost 14 years of data in here, that gas in the United States traded at parity very rarely. That would be whenever the line we see up here falls below 6, which is the dashed line right below the solid red. You can see there's very few months when gas is traded at parity or better than parity to crude oil. Mm-hmm. For the most part, anything that's above 6, the best way to describe it is gas is actually trading at a discount to parity with oil. The work that was done as part of AGEA suggested, based on the historical curves, that we would see gas on a long-run basis. And again, when you're looking at a pipeline, we don't want to pick one day. We want to look at what it would do over the long run. That on a long-run basis, gas would probably and most likely trade in the U.S. at an 8-to-1 ratio to oil instead of the 6-to-1 parity ratio.
Madam Chairman.
Oh, yes, Senator Stedman.
She's just enthralled in your chart.
Well, just wondering what's going to happen in the future.
Well, I'm just kind of curious how far back the data goes. I see here your chart goes back to 1995. But isn't the gas market, in particular the LNG market, just evolving, where it's turning into quite the global market, the ability of ships to virtually go anywhere, and the U.S. possibly turning into a banking site or a reservoir site to store excess LNG that is going to be in the global marketplace, and would that have an impact on this parity issue with the world becoming more gassed and less oil?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think you're absolutely right. The LNG market, which used to be very much a contractual market and a point-to-point market with very little trading or variability, has developed quite extensively over the last few years into much more of an open tradable market. I think the biggest indicator of that is that through 2008, I think we ended up with about one-third to one-quarter of the cargoes in 2008 that we'd had in a peak year coming into the U.S. That shows the volatility of that market, in that whereas I mentioned all the other markets like Europe and Asia are priced at 6-to-1 parity, and the U.S., as you see, is running on average in here 8-to-1, or even over the last 2 years, probably averaging 10 or 11-to-1 parity, that for that type of a difference, those cargoes will pick up and go to the markets that are paying a higher price. Now, there's been some talk by several consultants recently that, well, the U.S. is going to become a market of last resort, and that when these other markets tighten up, for example, Japanese nuclear is back on, European economy is down, so usage is down, and so their need for LNG comes down. We can run through all the arguments that they've made, that the U.S. will become a market of last resort. Well, even given the economic conditions that exist today, most of the pundits are predicting an extra 100 cargoes coming into the U.S. Those extra 100 cargoes this year will still not make 2009 the peak year for importing LNG into the U.S.
Senator Stedman.
To follow up, just a quick point as we, you know, roll through this, there's been numerous comments about looking at the entire cycle on this tax regime, you know, and I don't know if you're talking decades or 5 years or the 50-year life of it or whatever, but my understanding is our taxes are calculated on a monthly basis, correct? And that so, you know, we may have a period of 1 month, or maybe we have a string of several months that you know, may become problematic if we have some, from our perspective, I suppose the industry would have a exact opposite view, but it could be problematic to the Treasury. So I'm not so inclined to look at the whole life cycle of the gas line when we set this regime up, this gas tax structure.
Senator Stedman, the chair, Commissioner Gale will probably answer better, but my understanding was it's calculated, paid monthly, but it's trued up mm-hmm. over an annual basis.
Right.
Yes. Distinction monthly, annually, I mean, in the end, the question is, are we going to be bringing in a sufficient revenue for what we intended when we put the tax in place? And as we go through the slides, I think it's important to keep that in perspective, because when we show a slide, for example, that has a significant projected drop in overall revenue compared to what we would get if we were just in an oil world, and we get gas added in, we see a drop. We say, oh my gosh, we're losing money. That's a drain on the Treasury. Well, you have to sort of look, what are these underlying assumptions? If the underlying assumptions is we're out there with a 15-to-1 oil to gas ratio, and we're already building our assumptions on gas prices somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $6, $7, $8, then that means that we're only going to experience that when oil is selling up above $100 a barrel. And so the question is, in those few months, or maybe even a year, when we have that unique market dynamic,
it only comes about because we're bringing in a lot more money under oil. And I think all I'm suggesting is that we look at this in the total context of what that scenario means. Is it a sustainable one? Is that the way the relationship's going to be for the entire life cycle? Or is it going to be simply for a period of time, and during that period of time, what is the ultimate impact to the state?
I could just Senator a quick follow-up. Earlier comment from Senator Wilikowski on this, you know, oil being of a high value, gas being of a low value, you know, there's at least a reasonable probability that that may be the world we're in 20 years. And, you know, you could put forth the argument that you know, we should look at it in a much longer time horizon. But I could assure you that there's going to be a lot of people in the state concerned if it went on for 10 or 12 months or 9 months and we had a substantial decline in our gas revenue because of the progressivity dilution. That's something that I'm not going to want to go back to the public and say we're virtually giving our gas away if it's 1 month or 6 months. And we need to fix it. So we'll go on with the presentation and work on this over the next several months. But that's one of the major issues, I think, that are facing us.
And, Senator Simmons, I guess I agree with that we need to have that discussion. I think the question becomes one of we've got multiple issues or multiple interests on the part of the state. And this has been what we've been balancing throughout the whole tax discussion is the interest of maximizing revenues while also maximizing an incentive for investment. And I think what we need to always keep those two balanced. And that's my suggestion is that in the analysis that we've done, we believe that this does provide a very strong balance for incentivizing the investment necessary to develop the gas resource while also providing the state with a significant upside, but recognizing that there's also going to be instances where it provides a benefit to the companies to have our system stable and flexible.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay. Yeah. The next slide, what I just wanted to put on is, as I said, there were concerns raised about the validity of ACES for a gas development and long-term. And, you know, the numbers that were chosen to show an example of I believe what Senator Stedman just was bringing up, to where there's a loss of tax revenue instead of a gain with gas development, where things run at a 13-to-1 or even higher. And if I'm generous with where I placed my line, we see that it's about 6 months out of 14 years where that's actually existed for an entire month, and we never really have had a year where that type of gas to oil pricing was actually seen. So then we come down to this question of the subsidy. And I put together a number of charts to show, if you remember about five slides ago, I talked about there were many factors that come into play in deciding what the ultimate tax will be and whether that looks like it's a smart thing to do or not a smart thing to do in having them combined into one fiscal regime. I have a series of slides here, two or three, that I'm going to go through. The key, or the legend over here on the right, will tell you how this was worked, is we took the same model that Dan Dickinson had used and presented to you in February. The green is the tax that oil would pay on a standalone basis under ACES. The red is the tax that gas would have paid if the gas was on a standalone basis under ACES. The blue line represents the total tax paid under an ACES calculation when the two are combined, with the change being the impact of progressivity. The plot that we have up here right now shows the total tax being paid is the Y or the vertical axis, And across the bottom, we have the gas oil parity, remembering that 6-to-1, which is the second or third bar, is where the thermal parity is. 8-to-1 is what we're roughly saying has been the average over the last 14 years. And you'll see that as this shows, we have to come out here at 13-to-1 before we start to see that the combined tax paid, and this is a one-year snapshot, just a one-year, where the combined tax paid would be equal to and or less than just the oil standalone tax. If we look at this across a number of different parameters, because if you remember, one of the things that Mr. Dickinson's presentation did is he had an equal amount of gas and an equal amount of oil on a barrel of oil equivalent basis. And we said, actually, if we get closer to what is anticipated come the startup of a Alaska line in the 2018 time frame, and we go back to the presentations made by the oil companies during ACES, they felt that they would only have about 350,000 barrels a day of oil, which would be about half of what Mr. Dickinson used. You can see that this curve on the left, plot on the left, is based off 13-to-1 price parity. If we come to the 700,000 barrels, we'll see where the combined tax, the blue line, is just equal to what the oil would have paid on a standalone. But if we actually come down to the production, as likely noted by the producers, you'll see that the combined tax, the blue line, is actually above just the oil standalone. So actually the combined tax paid at the ratio of a 4.2 BCF a day pipeline to a 350,000 barrel a day oil production would be more than just the oil alone. If we actually go to price parity on the right, we did was change the price parity from 13-to-1 to 10-to-1. And you'll see across all possible amounts of oil relative to the gas that the combined tax is always significantly above just what the oil tax alone is. So even though you could say there's a subsidy, which would be the difference between the top of the red bar and the blue line, it is small in comparison to the amount of additional tax that would be paid when we're looking at parities more in line with what we expected. Now, as you can see, as I go from 13 to 10, the blue line moves up considerably and the red moves up considerably. If I actually went down to 8-to-1, it would even make that difference greater to where there is not any concern that you're actually paying less tax under ACES when you combine oil and gas.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, sure. Will we back up a slide? I think enough. And again, we're just getting into this. It's kind of like, look back, it's kind of like the initial introduction to the old 2020. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out what upstream was and downstream and midstream and all that other stuff. My understanding of this model, it was extremely simplistic, very high level, and that it pointed to a potential issue which we've discussed here, the dilution issue, and that more work needed to be done in advancing this model in complexity to get a better idea of what we're actually dealing with. And if we could hopefully in the end we won't have a blue line below the red bars, in my opinion, but if we could advance the one slide, and when we do these models, it's nice to see that, you know, there's $80 here. We spent a lot of time for the first, what, maybe 2 years on below $60, 3 years below $60 a barrel oil. And the dynamics or the marketplace that we were in operating then and today is, it's a whole different world. Oil went over $100, and a lot of us were struggling in the building here trying to get more analysis done above $60 a barrel oil. So hopefully when we go through this issue the next year, we're going to spend some time in the 80 plus 90, $100 world where progressivity kicks in, because that's the sweet spot for the industry and the state in particular. And also, just another bit of history, we've never had any discussion of any detail with this administration on the 20% credit. 20% credit was set in the previous administration and was basically left alone, and I'm not saying to change it. I'm just saying that that has just been a static credit, and that the intent is to get more exploration and development. And at some point through this whole process, we need to take a look at that to see that that is, in fact, doing what it's intended to do. And what the answer to that is, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Good points. Senator Wagner.
I can give you a brief summary on what the feeling of independent drillers and explorers are on that. They like it. Mm-hmm. Say it's working well. I had one in my office today on a entirely different subject, but he also is involved with a they just sputtered their second well on the North Slope. They said they would have never sputtered that well without those credits. So it is working. I don't know how much it's working, to what level it's working or anything else, but it is working, and they said it does allow them to do the drilling. Otherwise, they would have never been able to do the drilling. So, and they're sitting on top of a 50-50 play. That's what they're thinking. So it may work out good for us.
Madam Chairman.
Great. Yes, Senator Stedman.
You know, I would agree. I think for the small producer, you know, it is a good thing, and for the big producers, it's probably a good thing too. But it's just something that we need to keep in mind, you know, as we roll on. That is a huge incentive. The credit alone, not talking about the dilution issue, but just the sheer 20% credit as an economic stimulus.
Senator Stedman, we would agree that the value of the tax system is the combination of the two. It's the fact that we provide not only for a tax rate that reflects the profitability of the field, but also that we add in the credit for the investment in Alaska, going back to the way Rich presented at the beginning, saying it's not a net profits tax so much as it's a cash flow tax on tax cash that's left leaving the state. And the other observation is that two things. One is that we're happy to bring information with regard to this effect along whatever parameters that you'd like us to analyze, and that's a big nature of what we've done in looking at this particular issue, rather than just coming up with one static scenario and seeing how it tests. Mm-hmm. But the other side is that it's important for folks to understand that it is the same dynamic that provides what we see as a valuable incentive for investment in stressed fields, heavy oil projects that are marginal in terms of their individual economics, and providing an incentive for them to be added to the stream of existing production that causes the effect that you see. If we showed the effect of incremental investment in a new heavy oil field and adding that production, we could show it along the same chart where you'd have the incremental expected tax on one, the incremental expected tax on the other, and it's going to be more than what the combined expected tax would reveal. And again, it's a factor of the state choosing to create a system that incentivizes particular behavior. And in this case, the particular behavior that we're trying to incentivize is the commercialization of our gas, and not to necessarily maximize our recovery of taxes under the gas production scenario.
We'll continue our discussions.
Yes. And I'm nearing my end.
Yes.
I put back up the sort of the five goal slide that we started with, and I think the things we covered today is, one, we did show where larger profitability and larger cash flow per barrel fields do pay higher taxes. Mm-hmm. The encouragement of the investment, we showed where there is a bit of a subsidy to bring projects like gas on stream And I think, as Commissioner just said, you could actually have taken those slides we had up there, and with just a little bit of tweaking, even if you had only an oil tax, if that was heavy oil in the red instead of gas, that's exactly how it would work.
Yeah.
It would work the exact same way that we're showing for gas. So it really doesn't matter whether it's a liquid project or a gas project. It's what is its cash flow on a per BOE basis. I think the other thing that's been shown is, yes, we did pick some prices in which to run some cases. We're doing a comparison to what you've seen before. But the one thing I think you've seen is the durability in that when prices skyrocketed and went beyond where any of us thought they would go, the system kicked in the way you intended it to kick in. It would state to take its fair share of what it deemed that to be. But likewise, as prices have come down, unlike a gross tax, this is a tax on that net cash flow, and so therefore that tax has come down as well, which provides help to the producers to keep what they have on stream and producing.
And Rich, if you just...
And then building off that last bullet, the build on prior tax dialogue, one of the things that was difficult going into the eighth session was the fact that we were changing the system within a very short period of time after a major change previously. And it did impact our reputation as a tax regime, the stability of the system. And for that reason, as we move towards considering other changes, there's a certain threshold of demonstrated need that would need to be met in order to justify making additional adjustments to the system, and just to acknowledge that we want to keep stability as our overall theme. You're laughing at me.
I know it's not a comedy show, but sometimes it gets a little humorous in here.
Deja vu right now.
Mr. Ruggiero, you had mentioned that you were going to do some kind of analytical model, or your firm was working on their own model in response to the consultant that done some work for LBNA that, and then in turn had generated some of these charts or some of this data. I was wondering if you could give us a 30-second blurb on where that is and what your firm is doing.
Yes, Senator Stedman, through chair. One of the things that has been our approach, as much as we did in ACES, then we did in AGEA, and now in giving advice to the commissioner and to his team, is we're really trying to build something where we can look over a range of assumptions. As we mentioned up here, sort of as you saw in the one model which we put out about infill drilling in Prudhoe, is we're looking at the same type of thing, where we can turn on and off certain features, where we can take a look at running prices up and down, running cost up and down, linking prices and costs together, because in the oil patch there is a bit of a linkage, although there's a time delay on things. We are working to put that together so that way the state can be prepared that when numbers start popping out, such as what is now the latest estimate on a pipeline cost, what is the latest long-range forecast on gas prices that all the pundits seem to have or the oil companies are running with, that whatever comes up, that the commissioner and his team will be able to very quickly evaluate those scenarios and see how that impacts or how the fiscal system impacts that, or how any changes that anyone might be suggested to the fiscal system would impact such projects. And so I think when you have something that you can run a multiplicity of scenarios over, then you're much better prepared than running single-shot models and solutions.
Certainly, and on that point, this committee would be interested in any information you can share under your agreement. And specifically, I think you've heard the range of things. I mean, we're entering a new presidential administration with all kinds of different incentives and disincentives that will be put into the carbon world. Certainly the world of natural gas itself and the shale developments and LNG and so on. I mean, there's a goal of this administration to be 98%, self-reliant on natural gas in the next 15 years. I mean, you've heard Senator Stedman talking about us being a storage, United States becoming really a storage facility, if you will, for a lot of the gas that's out there. And one of the few places, really, we've heard, the exception of Spain, one of the few places that has the capacity for storage. So those kinds of things, as they develop, we're interested in, you know, the assumptions that you build in. And frankly, even though it's only been a year, the world does look a lot different. And $60 is even high right now. We don't know what'll change, but it'd be nice to see some of these models closer to the $50 mark. It'd be nice to see what assumptions you have with respect to gas supply and carbon tax. And I don't know, Commissioner, are those things that were allowed? I mean, I guess you could let us know what you can share.
Oh, sure. There isn't a tremendous amount of information that's provided to us that is not shared. We have, and the only thing that I would observe is that in addition to Gaffney Klein and the information that they provide us collectively on the analysis, we also have contract with Black & Veatch, with other folks, and as I said, Black & Veatch are working right now on a report that will be part of the public dialogue associated with some of the things that you just identified. And just to note, so that it's not confusing to the folks watching at home, a number of the things that you mentioned in terms of the current federal administration's push for more natural gas use in a variety of sectors for environmental reasons primarily is a sort of countervailing the idea of the United States as just a storage depot of low-cost gas. It actually is the inverse. And that a lot of what we see and what I think the folks that we talk to in the energy sector see is that this movement towards the natural gas demand side is a direction that is somewhat irreversible given a lot of other factors, and that is going to bode well for a high natural gas price in the long term, but it's getting us from here to there that is expected to take the significant dip in price, excess supply, use of storage, and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But in the end, as I started out, our gas line project is based upon long-term prices, not short-term prices. And for those reasons, all the things that you described all bode positively for our project.
Okay, anything further?
Nope.
Thank you very much for your time. We look forward to continuing the dialogue. And with that, Senate Resources is adjourned.